The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us this evening here at the Philadelphia Public Library. What a beautiful space this is. I'm a student of cities and urban affairs, and I love public places and particularly public libraries, especially when they're put to use as this one is tonight. My name is Henry Cisneros, and I am former mayor of San Antonio, and my principal association with Nelson Diaz was that I served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Clinton administration and brought Nelson aboard to be the Council General of the department. We spent a lot of time in Philadelphia in those days because there were real serious questions in public housing here, and it required an intervention from the federal government. And as a result, Nelson's knowledge of Philadelphia was really put to use at the national level. This is a special evening because Nelson has written a book that covers his entire life, and I mean that literally. The first paragraphs of the main section of the book begin with the image of Nelson's mother having just arrived from Puerto Rico, escaping an abusive situation, standing on the dock in New York, wondering what she would do, having arrived as a single woman, young, unemployed, and pregnant. And so she didn't arrive by herself, she arrived with Nelson. Someone was telling me tonight that there's many ways for people to get into the United States, but that is the sneakiest way they had ever heard. She joined family members in a very tough neighborhood in New York City, and it was there that Nelson learned literally to fight for his life. She worked very hard to put him into the schools that would afford him the best education, and so he went to Catholic parochial schools, including Rice High School. And the book describes the immense challenges of succeeding in that environment, but also the temptations that drew many young men and took them on roads that would destroy them. Gangs, guns, some of them ended up in prison, and others of them ended up dead. Nelson noticed along the way that the people that he admired, both within his family and in the community, were people who had an education. The people who were doing good things for others, the people who were advocates, the people who were building things, the people who were succeeding in business and in public service were people who had an education. So early on, he not only committed to academic studies, but also to mentorships and internships and following other people that he admired. He had uncles, he had a stepfather, he had instructors at Rice High School, he had leaders from the Puerto Rican community of the neighborhood that he grew up in. He succeeded well enough in school that it enabled him to go to St. John's University and then later to Temple Law School. Nelson always had an instinct for the public interest, so many of his assignments and responsibilities, even during his college years, moved toward that advocacy direction. He was early on selected to a very competitive program. Only 15 people in the entire United States every year are selected as what's called White House Fellows. It's a highly competitive and selective program that allows a young person beyond college, already showing some real capabilities in the workplace, in their profession, to come to Washington and serve either in the White House or as an assistant to to a cabinet officer. Nelson was a White House fellow, and he worked directly for Vice President Mondale in the Carter administration. It was one of those turning points in his life, shaping his view of the country, of public service, of how people at the highest levels perform. I was a White House fellow some years before Nelson, but the White House fellows sort of keep an eye on the subsequent classes, and it's how I first became aware of this outstanding young man from New York and Philadelphia, Puerto Rican heritage, who I was certain was going to make a big difference in his life. He returned from the White House fellow assignment and over a span of time became a judge here in Philadelphia at a time when the courts were under extreme duress with suggestions of corruption and so forth in the jurisprudence system. And Nelson was a bastion of honesty, so much so that he had to have protection for the threats that he got on his life. Time had passed, and I became Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. President Clinton asked me to serve in that capacity. And one of the first persons I thought of to join me was Nelson Diaz. I saw him at a public event during that period, and it just reinforced for me the way he carried himself when I learned about what he was doing in Philadelphia, the way the mayor here described him as this courageous person standing up for right and cleaning up the court system here in Philadelphia, that was a person we needed in the difficult assignment we had at HUD. So I asked him to join. President Clinton approved. We got him confirmed through the Senate, and he became the general counsel of the department. General counsel is the person who is responsible for breaking through the regulatory log jams, interpreting laws, putting in new programs, making sure that they're operated according to legal restrictions. And Nelson interpreted the job as one that settled lawsuits against the department, so the department was not bogged down but could move forward all across America, hundreds of lawsuits. And also interpreting the laws in such a way that we could do the job. A lot of lawyers will tell you what you can't do as a public executive. It takes a rare and special talent to say, what is it exactly we're trying to accomplish? I'll help you find a way through the minefield of the law to get there in a way that's constructive and accomplishes the objectives we're trying to accomplish. Nelson was that kind of general counsel. When we both left public service, he came back to Philadelphia, joined a major law firm, served as an advocate within the community, Solicitor General of the city of Philadelphia, asked by the mayor to serve as solicitor of the city, and eventually himself ran for mayor. All this time, an exemplar to younger talents, advising young people on how to get into public service, volunteering for all kinds of public initiatives, really a special human being. Let me just say, Nelson is one of the people I admire most of all the people I've encountered in many years of public service across the country. My favorite narrative in the American story is the story of the strivers. It's the narrative that brings tears to my eyes when I think of people who have incredible odds and they want so badly to do well and to help others that they just keep working against those odds. It takes immense character, immense vision, immense discipline, immense drive, immense ambition, and immense sense of hope. All of those are attributes that I attribute to Nelson Diaz. So you're going to hear tonight the rollout of his new book, his personal autobiography. And he'll be introduced by Sabrina Veroflavis, who has written extensively on and about Philadelphia. She's written for magazines, newspapers, including in the Spanish language. So she's exactly the right person to bring a sort of a multicultural perspective to the questioning, the interviewing that she will do tonight. Please join me at this moment in welcoming the interviewer, Sabrina, and the interviewed interviewee, Nelson Diaz. Ladies and gentlemen. I told Nelson to be prepared because he's going to undergo one of the most grueling interviews that he's ever experienced in his life.
So, Nelson, it's been a little while since I last interviewed you. Congratulations. If anybody has not seen his book. So I want to start in and broach some writing questions first and then get into the meat of the book, okay?
Before you start, I just want to say today is Charlie Bowser's birthday, who was a mentor of mine. I celebrated my 60th birthday in behalf of his daughter. We raised money for the mentally ill, and the book comes out on Charlie Bowser's birthday, who's a treasure to the city of Philadelphia and has been a great mentor to me, so I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. So when... It's appropriate because a lot of what you talk about is next generation and where they can go and how they... And Henry has said that this is really a book about hope in his preface. So when did you know you had a book?
I started the book, and it took me a year to go through. What I wanted to do was 12 chapters after I had done the proposal at the Temple University. And two professors reviewed the proposal and felt that there was almost no history on our community here in Philadelphia. And so they promoted it. I didn't start to write it. I was supposed to have it in a year. The second year, I started with an editor, who happens to be here, by the way, Justin Coffin, wherever he is, Justin Raviat over there. And he took a year with me. Didn't expect it to be that long. Then I gave it to Temple, and they took a year. So it's been 3 years in the making, and I have been able to update it over those 3 years.
Well, you know, Hemingway always said there's nothing to writing, you just open up your veins and bleed, you know. I think as readers of memoirs or autobiographies, there's something very interesting about getting into somebody else's head. As a writer of an autobiography, is that intimidating? And if so, what was more challenging, talking about the stuff that was deeply personal or the stuff that was public?
The stuff that was public was easy, and the stuff that was controversial was easy because my whole life has been controversial. The hardest part was to reveal some of my personal activities that had never been revealed to anyone, including my mother. Some of what you read in that book was very painful for me to relive it, since I had put it in one of these shelves and continued my life. And as I went through the growth coming out of both the tenement, that was a real issue, to the public housing when I really began to improve my life and my health. First time I slept in a bed, I was 10 years old. And so the beginning of that was really sort of more rewarding when I think about the African-American man that lived on park benches and collected 25 kids to play baseball.
So I'm going to start sort of working my way in through the different chapters, the way you sort of structured your life. Throughout it, obviously, you know, there are a lot of public figures that, you know, we would love to get all of the dirt on. You know, Mr. Cisneros,
Mondale. He has an impeccable life, you know.
Mondale, Clinton, Rendell.
Oh, there's enough written on Rendell.
So I want to start actually with your mother, because her presence really permeates the book. And one of the things you say early on, as you're describing your early family history, is that you come from a maternal line of struggle, and men appear and disappear. And that seems very apropos to some of the challenges Latinos in Philadelphia face. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, the mother's presence.
That's a good question. My mother came to live with me the last 3 years of her life. And the story is told from her point of view. It was extremely difficult to understand how a 9-year-old girl would run away from her home and never return and become a maid. It was difficult for me to understand how my biological father, who had children as old as my mother, essentially had a relationship with her, and she had to leave because he already had a family. So it was very hard to see the struggles of my mother with a third grade education and without an ability to have a life that one could claim is normal. And, you know, even one of her sisters died of hunger because my grandfather left with 14 children there, had two other children down the block, had a couple other children in another town, and he rode on his horse between two major towns, Humacao and Vega Alta, which was where the sugar canes were cut. This man was a very attractive man, 6'2", Indian-looking man, who really never took responsibility for any of those children.
So your mother knew that you were writing this book?
No.
No.
I didn't want her to know about the struggles that I had on 134th Street and that she left me at that stoop and that I was abused. Never shared it with anyone. The guy on the first floor, you know, brings me into his apartment, and there's no reason to bring me into the apartment, and I'm sitting in the stoop. My mother had to go shopping, so she thought I was safe. At 5 years old, I don't think any child is safe. And I lived with that the rest of my life until I was 70 years old, when I didn't care that anybody knew.
So it certainly seems to me that for those who have been assaulted, and particularly that young, there's always a feeling like, you know, what could I have been if this hadn't happened to me? But there's also the sense of, as poet Diane Gallo says, does the chalice regret the fire that forges it? You know, if you're a chalice now, wasn't this part of what made you who you are? Have you really grappled? This is one of the revelations of the book, is that you were sexually abused. Do you feel grappled with it?
Well, when I became 10 years old and moved to Harlem and learned how to be tough, no one ever messed with me again. And so I got really identified with the tough people and the gangs. And I felt those were the images and the so-called heroes that we saw on the street. I lived in a block where there was a famous man by the name of Cape Man, who had they have written about because of the Rockefeller situation where he his sentence was commuted from death penalty because he had been arrested at 16 years old. And so those are the heroes that I saw in my block. There was nothing related to education and nothing related to anything else but survival.
So, yes, you reveal that you broke into buildings with this little gang of friends, that you did some shoplifting. What would Judge Nelson Diaz have thought if his younger self had come in front of him in court?
That was really why, as a judge, everyone got a one shot at me. And I was extremely lenient to people who would come before me. I thought I was just, but some people would say lenient. And I would give everyone a first shot. Example, I gave an individual probation, and I asked them to report to me for every Friday for almost 2 years. Just before the sentence was over, he violated the probation. And I said, what did I tell you? He says, you told me 2.5 to 5. I said, goodbye, 2.5 to 5. And so it was a thing that I thought that I had to keep my word. And if I took a chance on you, I'm taking a chance also on my own reputation. And so no one wanted to be a violator in my courtroom. And, you know, the word gets around the prisons. Avoid violations with Nelson Diaz.
So I want to talk to you a little bit. You mentioned upstairs when we were speaking before that you spoke mostly Spanish as a child, that it took you a while to become literate in both languages. But one of the things that you repeat, and it's almost as deep a motif in your autobiography as it is, as your mother is the sense that your being Latino, and specifically Puerto Rican, made you ni de aquí ni allá, you know, neither a citizen as other citizens are considered, nor really a foreigner in this weird sort of both places and none. And you talk a little bit about your mother, her fighting to be understood over and over again. When did you hit that point at which you realized that having and mastering two languages was an advantage, not a disadvantage? And talk to me about specifically the Boricua identity and the challenges of that, particularly today.
I did not know it was an advantage until I came to Philadelphia. When I graduated from law school, and there were some issues of corruption with regard to the development of business opportunities in what I call the Bloque de Oro in North Philadelphia. The question was, if you don't take this job, we're going to lose our opportunity to do some economic development. So I had no choice. So I gave up the practice of law and took on that job. Everybody was Spanish speaking in that community. I had 250 merchants, none of whom spoke English. Mm-hmm. And so having the Spanish-speaking ability then became a real asset to me. But that's when I realized that it was important. I did translations as a young kid for adults and for others, but never saw it as just as a helpmate. But being able to put together, and if you look in the book, I put together a cooperative of these grocery store owners, mm-hmm. and this enabled them to be more competitive and taught them how to do retailing and marketing.
I've always thought that if you were born and grew up in El Barrio in Philadelphia, you could really get through most of the day without having to speak English if
That's
you didn't
correct.
Speak up in school.
That's correct.
You know, I'm interested in that balance of absolute, you know, pride in where we come from and the deep cultural roots that speaking Spanish provides, but the sense of foreignness that it layers on to us, you know, when Anglos look our way.
I'll give you an example. Just this week, and my wife was there when I received the call. I have a client who is one of the top contractors in Puerto Rico. And he found out about my book, and he says, oh, it's great to hear about American leaders. And when I'm here, they say, well, it's so great that, are you a citizen? It's so great to hear about you Latinos. And so you're not accepted in terms of, and that's a universal problem that we have as Latinos in this country, that we don't feel accepted here and we don't feel accepted in the countries that we go back. I tried to help the electric company, and that's written in the book. And we had had so much cooperation, and Michael Innocenzo's here, who sent a bunch of, he's the CEO, by the way, of PICO, and he sent a bunch of a ship with trucks and all kinds of assistance. But when I advised them of the process, and I'm here talking to the number 66th country in the Fortune 100, Exelon, they didn't take my advice and they decided to go to Wyoming and get a $300 million contract from a two-man firm. There is the real problem of acceptance from this side, as there is acceptance on the other side. When I was on Exelon's board, until I showed them that I could make the money, then they realized that I was smart. But prior to that, they thought I was just a diversity candidate. And I made them a lot of money. And I brought mentees that today are in the C-suites who happen to be Latinos. And I'm very proud of the fact that the only thing I did was, would you mentor this guy and see if he's smart? Oh, he can't be Latino if he's smart. Mm-hmm. I said, Joe, come over here. Are you Latino? Yes. Oh, okay. I guess you don't understand what it is to be a Latino. And those are the kinds of things that sort of, you know, in a nice way, you try to prolong, because you're supposed to be very collegial on these boards.
So one of the things, you said it earlier, and you say it in your book many times, and it was a plank of your platform when you ran for mayor, is the importance of education. And you said, I had a college degree, I had a future. Talk a little bit, I know that Peter Liakouras was somebody who really convinced you to stay in Philadelphia, to study in Philadelphia. Talk a little bit about that and what it meant to you to have him really, you know, push you to go on.
I was very good with numbers, and that's how I got through school pretty much, from the grade school over, is because numbers are Spanish or English, they are the same 12 numbers. So I was pretty good. And accounting, I was pretty much in the top of my class. And I was recruited by many of the then Big Eight accounting firms. And so I thought that was going to be my future. A month before graduation is when some professor, chairman of the accounting department, says, I sent you a recommendation to this guy for law school and you haven't followed up. I said, okay, I'll do it. I sort of sent it in, thinking that I probably couldn't get into any school. Why? Because LSATs, we didn't score well in LSATs, despite the fact that I graduated second in my class. And so that was going to be a hurdle. I then went to the summer program, thinking I was still going to work in the accounting firm. And Peter calls me, Peter Liakouras, and he says, we have a wonderful Latino community here. You're going to love Philadelphia. I think this is a place where you really can become a judge, you know, and really contribute to the Latino community. And so he sold me the bill of goods. I accepted without ever coming to Philadelphia. I had other offers, by the way. And when I came to Philadelphia, I stayed across the street from Progress Plaza. There was a hotel there that had thin walls, and people rented it by the hour. those of you who know Progress Plaza know how it was in 72. I was fearful that, you know, I had given up Harlem, which was, you know, my territory. I was tough enough to come to a community that was unknown to me. Anyway, I moved in, lived in an attic for a while until I could find a place to live, because I couldn't afford to live in North Philadelphia, of all places. So I went to Camden. And Camden had a really nice place for $110 a month. And I lived there the 5 years and commuted over to Philadelphia. And it would have been a lot easier to be here, but one of the advantages of being in Camden was, as you know, I grew up in the ghetto. I could open the door of Rutgers University, RCA building, and study there all night and all day, and nobody was there. I never got caught. And so it was an advantage to have my own library, not very far from where I lived.
So in the preface you say, and I quote, "I believe in Philadelphia. It's the ideal place for people who want to make a difference." And you became very politically active. You apparently were, you know, one of the founding members of the Black Law Student Association at Temple. You were involved with Hospita, with the Young Lords, and at the same time, you were a public defender. Self-described as hard-nosed, scrappy lawyer who stands up for those who have never had anyone stand up for them. So clearly social justice is a tremendous motivating factor for you. Tell me what personal quirk and what cultural quirk makes that so for you.
Yeah, some people who read the book tell me that it was my mother's influence. I believe that it was the intervention in my life that, but for that intervention, I would have been behind bars. But for that intervention, and Sarah lived in the same community, most of our friends died of an overdose of drugs or HIV. Very few people got out in that period because of the heroin addiction that had occurred in New York, and then the Rockefeller laws, so people disappeared. I was afraid. So I started to wake up, I believe. And I think it's part of that Pygmalion theory. If you really believe, and I really got a real conviction that God was within me and that nothing was impossible. I still believe that, and that's why I get myself in trouble. I believe that nothing is impossible, so I essentially sought out to do what I had to do to get out of Harlem and to get my parents out of Harlem. My stepfather got mugged 3 times in the month after I left, and so I wasn't there to protect them. So I got them out of Harlem. The only place I could afford was to send them to Puerto Rico, so they were there for a long period of time. So people who think that I don't know Puerto Rico really don't understand that no soy de aquí, no soy de allá, because I was there a lot longer than many who have lived on the island. And I believe that that whole intervention was what made me believe that I could do it. Now, as you know, I had the literacy issue. I had teachers who didn't care about me. I had teachers who flunked me because I would answer back. Nothing to do with academics, who almost killed my ability to go on to school, and these were religious. And it was naivety, again, about me and understanding what they were talking about, having, again, the language issue and having lack of understanding. So what I would do is I began to memorize books and give them back at exams. And I'm not sure I learned anything, but I passed every exam and graduated second in the portion of my class in high school after almost flunking out my first year.
Do you think that it was because you were an older brother that you sort of reached out and protected others, that you know, it wasn't only about you, it was about your family, it was about the community. When did that come into the consciousness of this young guy who was dealing with a lot of challenges and remaking himself?
Well, as soon as I shifted, by the way, at 15, I started doing income taxes for free for every member of the church. I started bringing kids to church and trying to get them to understand that there was a better way. I did everything I could to try to improve myself and improve the lives of others. I believe that that's the place that it happened, of basically a lot of influence from my mother bribing me to get to where I was. She'd made some mistakes in the bribe process. But when I'm doing the book, I realize that she was watching me and didn't know it. As we were doing the research, we found not only my lousy report cards, it was a shame. I said, why'd you keep all these D's? And she showed it to me proudly, like, you know, it was something I wanted to show someone. And she had a picture of me in the ballpark catching. I'd never seen that picture. I don't know who took that picture, and she had it. So to some extent, she had one eye on me. And then when I never got home on time, she would get my bat and chase me to get home with my bat, which was embarrassing as a gang member to have my mother chasing me with a bat. So I decided to hang out in a different part of this area to avoid her altogether. But she was a tough woman. When my father would come from work at 1 o'clock in the morning from being a doorman, she was outside the stoops with the same bat waiting to make sure he got home so that no one would mess with him. I don't know where she got that toughness, but you know, I guess living alone after you're 9 years old, there must have been something that she realized how she needed to survive.
So I want to sort of jump ahead and talk a little bit about your time at HUD. First of all, how Mr. Cisneros convinced you. Apparently, he had to repeat it several times that, you know, to get you there. But because you talk about housing being the preeminent public issue, and obviously in Philadelphia, we're still grappling with enough affordable housing and so forth. Talk to me about that and about later the Diaz opinion.
Yeah. I was an incredible admirer of Henry. There was no one like him in the country. There was no one who had a public figure and a private figure as he had. And I really wanted to do anything I could to elevate him to become president of the United States. That was my goal in Henry's life. Somebody has to be behind you. And so I never wanted to be the leader, and he was a quality leader. I mean, he could sit down with Clinton and demand that we get more cabinets, Latinos in the cabinet. If it wasn't for him, our first woman would not have been, Latina woman would not have been in the cabinet, and he gave me the privilege of calling her. And he stood by the door of Clinton all night until he came back, and this is going to be the day, the next day was the day where they swore in the cabinet, and there was no one there. So he's a very convincing guy. He told Federico Peña, you're not going home, you're going to be Secretary of Energy. You go home in a year when we get somebody.
So do you?
He was on the move, and he stayed.
Do you think he's going to run for president?
Oh, I wish he would, but but Henry doesn't want to put himself through the public disgrace that Trump is putting himself through, and he's a lot more intelligent than that. He's the smartest man I've ever worked for. When he told me he had these cases, the civil rights cases that were lingering in the background, I said, Henry, don't worry, I'll take care of it. He left me alone all 4 years. At the end, he said, Nelson, you took care of all those 23 cases? Yeah, he was leaving the office, he's signing the last case, which is the Texas case. We spent $9 billion of his budget to resolve many of those cases. And what we saw within that was his theory that you needed mixed income people in the community, and that housing didn't have to look like public housing, it could look like market rate housing, and that why can't developers participate. So he said, find out why we can't do this. Well, we researched everything we could, and there was no reason why we couldn't do it, because as a judge, you think of what, when you commit a crime, what the elements of the crime are. And you're found guilty or not guilty based on that. So that's my thinking. There was nothing in the law that didn't say we couldn't do it. And so lawyers in the government look at authorization and appropriation. Okay, we had money, but we didn't have authorization. So I wrote an opinion that Henry liked, which is, unless prohibited by law, we can do this. And so we wrote a rule, and it revolutionized public housing. And not only did it do that, but and one of the things about Mondale that I probably got from osmosis, one was bilingual education, and Federico Peña, who also was with us, lobbied me in 77, 78 for bilingual education, and I loved bilingual education because obviously I had the difficulty. We got the last bill through Federico and Mondale, and then Mondale wrote the Fair Housing Act. I finish off with Henry. We essentially develop a theory of disparate impact, and the Supreme Court 2 years ago, the only basis in any discrimination, which is usually direct, disparate impact was approved by the Supreme Court by Kennedy's opinion, and that's Henry's legacy. Henry was able to bring about a change in not only the ability to have housing that looks like everybody else's housing, that's his thinking, and that housing also is fair and equitable to all.
I'm going to interrupt you because I've already been given the 5-minute mark, and there's a lot of your life we haven't even touched upon. You know, there are great quotes in the book, including you were city solicitor under John Street, and this is a quote that boggles the mind. I had more fun as city solicitor than I had had in any job I had ever held. I really encourage you all to buy the book so that you understand why. I want to talk to you quick, my last sort of question here, about your mayoral run. I covered your mayoral run, you have said that the alliances that were struck and dissolved so quickly was the thing that you were most shocked by. You also have some pretty blunt words for politician and person, Mayor Kenney. And since the book has taken 3 years to come to where we are now, you have said, late in the game, he made a turn toward progressive politics, but it appeared to me to be about positioning and not about principle. Do you still feel that way about him?
Well, I don't want to judge the man anymore since I'm out of the picture. But what was striking to me is that I wasn't a politician throughout all those efforts. I was an advocate, whether I was working for Charlie or working for someone. What I was looking for an opportunity to make life better for our community. I then sit at home and see how bad the school system is. And I have a client in Camden who educates 100% of her kids, graduates 100% of her kids, and 100% go on to college, and they're in Camden, and we're in Philadelphia. What's the difference? So I feel that, you know, I had a very comfortable job that I gave up. I gave up $3 million of income by running for mayor. Everybody wants to kick me and tell me what an idiot I was because of that. But you have to have some principles in life. And the principle was education in this city is killing our kids. And if we don't do something about it, there's no future. So it was one of those Don Quixote things that I go into. And so I feel, here's the election. Easy. Nobody goes out to vote. If I get the Northwest, I win. If I don't get the Northwest, I don't win. They're the only people that vote in the city. It's the Northwest. And so Dougherty knew that. And so Johnny Doc creates a fund that is not at all alleged to be coordinated with the campaign. And you know, the allegations in terms of the law. And so when he creates that fund, I couldn't compete not only with the fund and with the people who I had first supported in my civil rights activities. That was ages ago as far as they're concerned. And secondly, they're politicians now. They're no longer those civil rights people.
But you represented Latinos. You know, representation is something we talk a lot about in libraries, you know, to have somebody named Nelson Diaz on the shelf and have the book there. We talk about it as writers. We talk about it politically. You represented. And I think toward the end of your book, you say, I can only look to the next generation of activists, firebrands, and just regular folks who stubbornly live their lives and refuse to take less than what they deserve. They have a great opportunity. And it strikes me that your book is really like your run for mayor. It's about representing, and it's about those younger Latinos looking and seeing a Latino who has written his autobiography, who has been the first in so many ways, who made a credible run for a mayoral office. I know we're going to go to audience questions pretty quick, but my final question for you is, you know, humility and humbleness aside, are you proud to be a role model, a mentor, a role model for young Latinos?
My history says that I'm here to open doors for those that follow me. I did it as a young law student when only 67 African Americans have ever passed the bar before 1972. I did it for Latino lawyers when there were none in the city. I'm doing it for corporate directors. I organized the Latino Corporate Directors Association, and we're opening doors to have Latinos, and there's only 2.2% Latinos in corporate boards. And so I'm doing it in that area. So I believe that my role in life is to open doors. And by running for mayor, I knew once the Northwest that it was over, but I knew that education was important. So I pushed the envelope, and I got Kenny to believe that education is the element. And so I believe that his ability to talk, because they had no platform. I mean, all they had was Doc in the Northwest. His ability to push the pre-K and push those issues, essentially, I believe, were related to having run for mayor. And so what I tell others is, when you get into this, you got to be willing to lose. I didn't have the resources, but you know you don't use the resources when you know you're going to lose. So by the time I saw that, hey, I pulled back. So I was dumb, but I wasn't going to mortgage my house. Those are the kinds of things that one has to be a realist about. And I can live with myself whether they like me or not. By the way, thank you so much for coming. I'm not sure that... I look in the audience, I see a bunch of young lords, you know?
You've done a great job on the Board of Trustees of Temple. So do you talk about that in the book?
I try not to talk about confidential information as of yet, but I do talk about the board of the hospital, which I'm off, and what I did at the hospital board. But that is something I am willing to talk about when I'm off of the board of the Temple University, because I have opinions that you've seen in action and votes that I've taken in the minority. We have a long way to go in terms of the Commonwealth theory. And so to some extent, You know how I feel about that because you've seen me in action. And I'm usually 25 to 1, you know?
Your Honor, gracias por su servicio. Un honor hablar con usted, Will Gonzalez.
Thank you, Will.
You've worn a robe. You've been in the White House. Sorry I'm asking a tough question, but can you talk about the state of our country today and the leadership that we have at the federal level? What's your impressions?
I'm going to be very brief on that. Cisneros and I have spoken about that, and we are worried on the immigration issue, and we're also worried about the fact that based on the polls, 40% of the public agrees with this administration, and 90% of Republicans agree with this administration. So I don't see where there's going to be a change in the foreseeable future, but I would love to see a change in which we bring back Obama's graciousness, Obama's ability to be polite, and Obama's ability to take on issues without being a liar. So I don't know what else I can say about that.
This is kind of an extension of that question.
This is Margie Margolis, one of the women that I highly respect. She gave up her vote for the good of the country and lost the race. Henry and I were there watching you take that vote, and we were so proud of you, and we love you to death because it was the right thing, and the economy improved.
Thank you. My question really is, you know, we are a great country because of people like you. We're a great country because of people who gave up everything to come here. And we had a refugee family living with us for 20 years. And we watch these people grow up, and it's just painful to see somebody who calls refugees terrible people. I want to know what we do. You've kind of answered the question, and I know you don't want to get there because you're trying to be diplomatic and nice.
Well, you know, we celebrate Columbus Day today, right? So we can talk about the fact that there were people here when he got here, and the rest of us came in right after that. And so there's nobody here who was here before the American Indians. So they were all immigrants. And this country is built on the back of immigrants. And we don't understand how important it is. And in my book, I talk about some of the fights that we have in Kensington and the other side and how we sort of move up and how those fights were there before when the Germans didn't want the Irish to be here. So, you know, it's so important for people to realize how we have to work on this issue and how we have to change policies. And we just don't vote. I told you, 11% of the turnout for the mayor's race. And 11% both, the primary and the general. People don't vote. And so as a result, we get sometimes what we shouldn't have because we feel that this democracy, you know, will take care of itself, and it won't.
Nelson, if you could tell everybody how the ballots in Philadelphia became bilingual.
Well, you know, I sued him. That's how I became bilingual. When I got out of law school, I sued everybody. Gene Mayer and I are in Judge Kahn's chambers, and fortunately, he never held it against me through the years. We were in law school together also, we agreed that 5% or more, and thanks to Gene Mayer, we were able to get ballots. But I also sued on bilingual education. I sued on the civil service exam. It wasn't until I worked for Mondale that I realized there's other ways to get a solution.
You're married to a lawyer, right?
Yes, and she always wins, though. That's Carmen Fairball. You got to visit her. Visit her talent, Taller Puerto Riqueño, which is one of the organizations that I helped found.
Thank you, Nelson. And like Will, you know, we admire you and thank you for all of the trailblazing that you've done throughout your life. My question is about Puerto Rico and, you know, the unfair relationship, legal relationship that the United States maintains, maintaining a, you know, a colony in this day and age. You know, what is your sense, and do you have any, you know, any vision of, you know, what we in the diaspora hopefully can do? Since Puerto Ricans don't vote, it may, you know, be up to us to try to figure out a legal way of pushing the envelope and seeing if we can accomplish some change that benefits the island.
Yeah, I have had a relationship with every governor since Rafael Hernández Colón, which was basically our second governor. And I tell you that there is something about the princes that they have and the air that they have that they always know better than the rest of us out here. And until we realize that all they're doing is fighting about status instead of about governing, they've never governed. And what I saw, first time I ever worked in a government job in Puerto Rico was when I was trying to help them with the electric company.
Nelson, sorry to interrupt you. We've come to the end of our time, and I want to be able to say thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
For every aspect of it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.